Welcome to Commas.
Commas is all things tech.
We see culture and technology coming together.
Life hacks.
The practicality right now in the inefficiency of the internet of buying and selling stuff is extraordinary.
Entrepreneurship advice.
I think the first thing is you got to understand your business inside out.
Love and tech.
We've almost reduced dating to kind of this very momentary snap of a person.
It's going to be a fire show.
I have yet to see something these days that's truly differentiated.
New advice and new inspiration every show.
This really is about the next generation of creators going faster, further than we did.
And now, Sequoia Blodgett.
Now let's start stacking them commas.
On today's show, oh my God. What do I want to say about Michael Ellison? He had 6 startups before CodePath, and he raised $1 million from Facebook, which is just like give or take. Like there's still some things in there, and that's literally just the tip of the iceberg. So excited for you guys to hear this. And I'm going to answer all of your questions from the gram. This is going to be fire.
Entrepreneurship advice. Learn from the hottest and most successful investors, founders, and innovators in the game.
Determine your greatness.
It's time to get your knowledge up.
Okay, for sure.
What's poppin'? We've got special guest Michael Ellison on the line. He's the founder and CEO of CodePath, an organization that provides free in-person coding classes and access to tech companies for students. How are you, Michael? Welcome to Commas.
I'm doing wonderful. How are you doing, Sequoia?
Amazing. So tell us about your story and how you got into tech.
My story was kind of interesting because I actually started when I was 19 years old with founding my first company in college. And it was a bit unintentional because I wasn't trying to be an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. I ended up working with going to these low-income high schools near where my school was in Boston. And we just wanted to start a campus club. And we started that campus club by just asking students how we could help them out. And one thing led to another as we tried to just solve more and more problems by asking people what their problems were. That ended up becoming my first company, which was a nonprofit. And then that led to me wanting to figure out how to make bigger and bigger impact, to eventually ended up founding 3 tech startups and then 3 nonprofits.
That's a lot. So tell us about these tech startups and nonprofits that you founded.
Well, so the most well-known nonprofit is Women Who Code. I was the first founding board member, and then served on the board for about 4 or 5 years. For those who don't know, Women Who Code is the world's largest organization supporting professional female engineers. So I don't know how many members they have, 150, 180,000, something crazy like that, but
wow,
they're all over the place. and that was a number of years ago. And then the most well-known tech startup I founded is a tech startup called Segment. We went through an accelerator called Y Combinator back in 2011. And that organization is now one of Y Combinator's highest value portfolio companies ever. And I think it's unofficial, but pretty soon, officially, I'll probably be the company that is the most valuable, founded by a Black founder.
Tell us about that company.
So back when I started in 2011, it was actually called Classmetric, and we were focused on providing a layer of analytics and student support in the classroom. And it was pretty simple how we actually get into Y Combinator. You know, when it comes to investors, it's all about speed of execution. It's all about having an amazing team. And I recruited the founding team out of MIT, and they weren't just kind of the normal MIT engineers. Not to say that most MIT engineers are normal, but mm-hmm. they were kind of the MIT engineers that would make fun of most of the other MIT engineers as not being technical enough. And we ended up, over the span of really a couple of weeks, we ended up building a prototype. We ended up getting paying customers, which were the college and university departments. And then they were paying us for this very basic tool, which students would indicate whether they understood or did not understand what was going on in their classroom. And we would overlay that on top of PowerPoint. So it was like this snapshot into whether your lecture was effective and what we hoped would become something that would change the student experience and help a lot more students succeed in their courses. So the pace of that traction, the speed of that, really impressed the Y Combinator partners, and also drew a lot of interest from different investors in Silicon Valley.
So how did you detach yourself from that company then to go start another company? Because I think that's something that's really interesting. A lot of people think they're stuck at the company that they start. So what was that process like for you?
Well, you know, it's more about work with the best people you can. And it's really, really critical when you're looking at a startup to have a true north with that aligns with your passion. Startups are really hard and they're very discouraging. There's ups and downs. There's lots of downs. And when it came to that startup, and that was, you know, that there were startups before that, there were startups after that. With that one, it was more about the idea we initially worked on ended up getting a lot of initial traction, but it wasn't the opportunity to transform education that we hoped it would be. And we actually went through kind of this period of time where we weren't really sure what we were building or what we were doing. And I, you know, have always been very optimistic. And so I ended up moving on to the next thing. And then some of the team members stayed on working on that project. And a couple of years later, I get an interesting phone call about, hey, do you want to sell your equity shares? They're worth a decent amount at this point in time. And so I don't try to take credit for, you know, everything that's happened and how that's happened. But, you know, it's kind of awesome to see what has developed with the company. And you know, kind of the recommendation is to always find and look for people who are so talented that they intimidate you. But there's also a good alignment and a good fit. And I've always been the type of person that I try to network and connect by just seeing how I can be helpful. And that leads to a great network over time.
That's really cool. So when you got this call and they were like, hey, do you want to sell your equity and sell your shares essentially? Did you have to vest mm-hmm. over time? Like, what did that process look like?
Yeah, so it was already vested. So from earlier. When I had left the company, we left on good terms, and as part of a goodwill, they accelerated some of my founding shares, and then I thought that, you know, I mean, most startups never really go anywhere, but turns out they did.
You're like, yes, I will take that money. Thank you.
Well, on paper, it's on paper. So, you know, I can't do that much right now.
That's great. And you have a twin brother who's also in tech. So what has that process been like? I know he's overseas and he's doing his thing over there. So how, I wonder two things. What is his perspective being overseas and actually being in the tech industry there? And then what is the process like with you guys both working in the industry together?
It's kind of weird. He actually moved out back to San Francisco. I convinced him to move over.
Oh, did
there,
he? He's like, I'm months. Coming yeah. back.
Yeah, and it's just kind of I kind of remember why I wanted to go to a different college than him. When someone looks exactly like you and identical twin and they're working in the same industry, then people confuse you all the time with them. Mm-hmm. It's kind of weird because, I mean, he'll just reach out to anybody I know and he's like, oh, hey, I'm Michael's twin. And then it's like he has a connection with them, too. And
you're and like, hey. Kind of,
I mean, it's kind of he's ambitious and he's doing good work. And the thing is, like, sometimes he might for one of my board members to become one of his investors. Then I'm like, hey, like, that dude's busy. Like, don't take up his time. Like, the reason why he's not meeting with me this week is because he's meeting with you this week. And so there's actually that's an example that has happened recently. And so I'm like, Marcus, come on, man. You need to lay off my network sometimes. And it's also, you know, one of the weirdest things is, you know, he's dating and all that. And I'm married, and sometimes I get approached by people, and I've known them for a while, and they come up to me, they say, hey, so, so I matched with your brother on Tinder. And I'm like, yeah. And why are you telling me that? And it's, you know, the person's kind of like saying, I like you, but they can't say that. But they, like, I don't know. It's just weird. Like, you know someone for a while, and then they start telling you about how they connected with your brother and haven't gone on a date yet. I don't know what to do with that.
You're like, you need to talk to him about that.
Yeah, so it gets kind of messy. I try to, you know, separate that personal professional stuff much as I can.
That's so funny. So you're the founder of CodePath. What made you decide to start a coding school?
You know, it really is based on Nathan and Tim. They were the two original first super talented engineers that got together, and they wanted to create programming courses to make it easier for engineers like themselves to learn new technologies. And I got connected with them very, very early. Actually, I was introduced by the current CEO of Women Who Code before Women Who Code was a nonprofit. And she just said, hey, you're going to love meeting these people. You're super aligned. And for years and years, I've just been obsessed with how do you create better pathways to help people reach their full potential? Nathan and Tim were also extremely obsessed with that. I come from a low-income background in rural Maine, and I always felt like my educational experience, there's things I was missing. You know, I was raised mostly by my mom, me and my three brothers. And so you always see the gaps when you go to school and you're sitting in a class and you have to rely entirely on whatever the teachers are teaching or whatever the current course. And depending on the class, it makes you love or hate whatever subject. And I just always felt like I would have loved to have a better educational experience to help me to go further and faster. And then technology completely transformed and changed my life and my entire family's life. So when we linked up with Nathan and Tim, then it was obvious to us that we needed to figure out better ways to unlock the transformative potential of education. And then when it came to teaching engineers, then we just feel as if technology has this incredibly powerful opportunity to completely lift people out of poverty, to transform lives and transform pretty much anything you'd want to do, regardless of whether that's actually being a software engineer. It's really, I like to describe it as you have a comfort level with using the best tools available in the world to solve or to apply to whatever type of problem or whatever type of work you want to.
And then you just got Facebook involved too, and they made a $1 million investment, right? So what was that like? How did you get them to come on board?
If I have a superpower, it's probably building deep relationships with executives and building champions and building sponsors and this stuff like that. And they're not the only company I've gotten to invest a significant amount of money. It's really people want to give money to an organization if they trust you, and that takes time and it's a slow process. And so it's really all about knowing who the right people are and then putting in the work and the time in order to build that trusting relationship, in order for them to appreciate that you do have unique expertise. And when it comes to Facebook or any of the other companies we're working with, then it's all about that one-to-one connection. And it's actually really not more complicated than that. It's connect with the right person, build the trust and the relationship. And then if they have the power to do something, then it feels like a friendly conversation and a brainstorm. So about a year and a half ago, I was the person sitting with the Facebook executive, and he was like, hey, you know, what do y'all want to do and what are you interested in? And I'm like, here's the vision, and this is how we can get there. And the vision was to transform computer science education as a way to increase diversity in tech, allowing us to dramatically increase the entire size of the pipeline of Black software engineers and Latinx software engineers and more.
Why do you think it's so important for students to be involved in coding, considering like there's a lot of AI that's taking over that? And like, why do you think that that's such a focal point?
Well, There's a couple major things happening. The majority of job growth, the fastest growing areas of our economy, the highest paying salaries, you're looking at that in the technology sector. At the same time, you have so many jobs that are going away due to automation and AI, and a lot of the emphasis from a workforce development standpoint, there's a lot of talk of various middle skilled jobs, and it might be something, you know, like truck driving or whatnot. And a lot of these jobs are going away or won't exist in 5 to 10 years. If you aren't able to develop the skills and specifically like coding skills and also digital literacy, if you're not able to develop those skills, then your prospects are not very bright. And as I mentioned before, coding is not just, it's not just become a programmer. It's if you're a designer or if you're a program manager or a product manager, or if you go into finance or you go into so many of these different professions, it is becoming more and more essential for you to become more and more technical and have a comfort level with simply just using the best tools that are available in order to accomplish whatever task you need to accomplish. It's a game changer, and I think it's as important as just being able to read and write with, you know, being able to use whatever type of software or understand how that works or understand how you can personally be more productive or your organization can be more productive with just better tools.
That's dope. What are some of the success stories that have come out of the school so far?
So we have we've grown pretty fast over the past year, and we have been able to significantly change not just what's being taught inside college campuses, but how it's being taught. And it's not just that we create curriculum, we'll train professors or students a semester advance. We do the grading when the course is actually running. We have extra layers of student support. This makes certain outcomes that used to be very unlikely to actually be something that is probable. And one example is there's a kid that I've gotten to know over the past couple months named Omar Valenzuela. He went to one of the lower performing high schools in California. It was 90% of students on free or reduced lunch. The school students only have 16% have proficiency in math, and there's no AP courses. And it comes from a low income, first generation college student. And he ended up attending UC Irvine. Coding is getting, and specifically computer science is getting very hard to major in because there's a nationwide shortage of CS professors. And so it already was a weed out course when you talk about intro to CS, but it's getting more and more hard to even declare that as a major. He wasn't allowed to declare that as a major when he went to UC Irvine. Took the courses anyways because he just loved computers. And by the time he got to his senior year, he never had a technical internship. And you know, when you don't have a technical internship, you actually can't get jobs at technology companies because they require work experience. When we connected with them, he was rejected from every program that would be a lifeline for him, from management leadership for tomorrow, which we love them, but they do require, you know, work experience to get in, Code 2040 was rejected from that as well, because again, they look at that resume screen. He took our courses this past summer, and then he ended up getting offers from Chan Zuckerberg Initiative. Google, Facebook accepted an offer from Chan Zuckerberg Initiative this summer, and his previous work experience was he was working at a coffee shop.
Wow.
So this is a game changer. And the thing is, there are so many talented people from underrepresented backgrounds, but if you're not going to a top school already in a top program and already are among that top few that's worked inside of a good company, you're invisible. And we have countless numbers of people who are invisible, and then it makes it very hard for them to persist in computer science because they aren't able to get jobs, and then they end up going into other areas. So we're trying to solve this at the root and to make sure that students aren't just filling in the missing skills, but also making sure that they have access and that they're no longer invisible, but they actually stand out. And a very important way that that happens is the same course that we're teaching over in, let's say, UC Irvine is the same course that's being offered over at Merritt College in Oakland. It's the same course that's being offered at Purdue University. This is a game changer. You can take one course and then you can stand out among any student in the country, and then tech companies will take notice as well.
That's amazing. So we're going to play a game really quickly. We're going to test my coding knowledge. So you're going to tell me two truths and a lie about coding and see if I can figure out which one is the lie.
Two truths and a lie.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
About, how technical you want to get?
Oh, don't get too technical.
Yeah. Okay. So two truths and a lie.
Don't be too easy on me, but don't like throw. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. So, let's start with, you use Xcode in order to build iOS apps.
That's one. Okay. Truth. Keep going.
Okay.
Don't tell me yes or no yet. Go ahead.
And then, I'll say, how about another is, 80% of underrepresented minorities, 80% plus of underrepresented minorities drop out of computer science.
Truth. Okay, give me one more.
And Marmalade is an Android framework.
Okay. I'm going to say that's a lie. I have never even heard of that, but okay, you tell me. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, you got it right. It probably made it a little bit too easy. I didn't want to go too deep for you.
I like that though. I feel accomplished. The only reason that I know that Xcode is what you said it is because when I was building a prototype probably like 3 years ago, and I had never coded before in my life, and I opened up my laptop, and I don't even remember what program I was in, but I was just like, I gotta get this done. And so I'm sitting here trying to code, and somebody came in, and they were like, no, don't do it. Like, just go to this platform and use this for prototyping. I was like, I was so stressed out because I could not get it to do anything. So yes, I had a horrible experience with Xcode, and that is how I know that that is the truth.
So it's one thing about the Marmalade with Android. It would have been possible for you to get it wrong, I guess, because all of the Android updates they're all sweets. It'll be like cupcake or donut or eclair or froyo.
Okay. Yeah, I wouldn't have known the details. Yeah. So yeah, that definitely could have been a possibility. Cool. Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us. But how do people who want to connect with you actually find you or CodePath?
Yeah. So you can go to CodePath's website, www.codepath.org, and we publish everything on there. So you can click around and see quite a bit about what we do and how we do things, and have free career guides and free videos on how to pass technical interviews and everything we do. We just share it with the world. And then my Twitter is Michael W. Ellison, so at Michael W. Ellison. And then I'm happy for people to just send me emails, michael@codepath.org. I'm pretty open.
It's life hacks.
Life hacking, baby.
Tech tips and tools for everyday needs.
Tap in.
Control, copy these shortcuts and simplify your life.
You heard us.
To all my couples out there, I have got the life hack for you. Do I hear wedding bells? If so, Zola is the easiest way to plan your wedding and registrar. There are over 500,000 couples who've used Zola, and it takes the stress out of wedding planning with free wedding websites, your dream wedding registry, affordable save the date and invitation, and easy to use planning tools. You can conveniently manage everything online all in one place. It literally saves so much time for couples. First, you start with a free wedding website, and it's so easy and literally just takes minutes to set up. You can choose from over 100 beautiful wedding website designs that fit any couple style and every type of wedding. Zola makes it easy to personalize your favorite design with all of your wedding details.
Add photos, stories about how you two met, travel and accommodations info, and even recommend things to do for your guests while they're in town for your wedding. An FAQ section helps address those awkward questions like, can I bring my kids? Or do I have a plus one? You can put your Zolo registry on your wedding website so guests can get all the details they need and buy your wedding gifts in one convenient and beautiful place. It literally saves so much time for couples. First, you start with a free wedding website. It's so easy and takes just minutes to set up. You can choose from over 100 beautiful wedding website designs that fit any couple style and every type of wedding. Zola makes it easy to personalize your favorite design with all your wedding details. Add photos, stories about how you two met, travel and accommodations info, and even recommend things for your guests to do while they're in town for the wedding. A FAQ section helps address those awkward questions like, can I bring my kids? Or do I have a plus one? You can put your Zola registry on your wedding website so guests can get all the details they need and buy your wedding gift in one convenient and beautiful place. Then build your dream registry at Zola. Zola makes registering for newlyweds' life so easy, and Zola Stores has the widest selection of gifts at all different price points. There's something literally for every guest to give. On top of that, guests love the free shipping and returns, price matching, and more. Over 500 top brands from OXO to Cuisine Art to Sonos to Airbnb. To start your free wedding website and also get $50 off your registry on Zola, go to Zola.com/fearless. That's Zola.com/fearless.
Yo.
Love, life, and tech.
With Sequoia Blodgett.
Just part of our culture.
Because balance is real between the swipe culture, mental health, personal growth, career, and just about everything in between.
Just keeping it real.
It's a lifestyle.
Incredible vibes, incredible people.
Love, life, and tech.
What's up, you guys? It's Sequoia, and I am back, and we are answering all of your entrepreneurship questions from the gram. I'm super excited about this batch of questions because it's not just practical. There are a lot of questions that are obviously informational that you guys want to know as entrepreneurs, but there's a lot of questions in here that actually have something to do with how you deal with entrepreneurship on an emotional level. And I think a lot of the times that stuff doesn't get addressed. So thank you guys so much for submitting. And if you guys are interested in submitting in the future, go ahead and hit up our gram at Commas the Series. All right, let's jump into it. So how do you deal with uncertainty? That's a really, really good question. That question came from, you know, I'm going to keep them actually all anonymous. One, I don't want to butcher anybody's name. And two, some people asked me to keep them anonymous. So I'm going to go ahead and adhere to your wishes and keep them all anonymous just for, you know, practicality's sake. All right. So how do you deal with uncertainty? So uncertainty for an entrepreneur can mean a couple of things. It can mean not knowing where your next paycheck is coming from. It could mean not knowing where your customers are coming from. And I think as an entrepreneur, the way that you've dealt with uncertainty is just you have to just brave it out. Myself, I've always dealt with uncertainty by just doing whatever it is, right? So when I was directing commercials and music videos, uncertainty for me meant not knowing when the next artist was going to book, when that check was going to come. And it just made me grind even harder to figure out what that next thing was. And so that is a lot like entrepreneurship in the sense that you don't know who your next customer is going to be, especially when you're early stage and you're actually building the business. You're really not sure who that customer is in the beginning, and then you're not even sure who are they going to be paying? Are there going to be more of them? Like, there's tons of uncertainty going throughout the process. And I think that you just have to attack it head on. Don't try to delineate or don't try to navigate around it because it just makes things really, really difficult. I think just attacking it head on and just knowing it's going to be a thing, like, you're going to have times where you're just not certain of many, many things as an entrepreneur. And you just have to deal with it, right? So I think that's one thing that you can definitely kind of take out of that question is dealing with uncertainty is just dealing with it. Just know that it's a thing and it's going to happen, right? So should I invest my own money or look for investors? Oh my gosh. Okay, you guys know how I feel about this. you looking for investors is not a good thing if you are just starting out. You definitely need to bootstrap, meaning invest your own money into your company because you have skin in the game and you also have control over your company. And to be honest, most investors do not want to invest in a company that doesn't have the person, the founder who's invested in it already. So meaning they haven't built an MVP, they haven't got traction for the company, especially on the venture capital side. They are not messing with you if you don't have some type of profitable company, meaning you have traction, you have a good team, or at least if you're a solo entrepreneur, you've built product up to the point of scale. And then they're interested in having a conversation with you. But I don't know, it's been a conversation lately that a lot of people are like, oh, I want an investor, I want an investor. Like, an investor is not a team member in terms of, they're not, I spoke about this on the last episode, they're not another co-founder. They don't want to join your team to work on your company. They want to invest to make a profit on their side, right? So essentially the even exchange is they're investing because they want to be profitable and they're giving the money to you so that you can make money and be profitable for your company at scale. So it's an even exchange to the sense is they're helping you grow the company, but they're not a co-founder in the sense where they're coming on board to help you deal with logistics and all that stuff. Like, invest your own money, get the company off the ground, get it up and running, get the traction, and then go talk to an investor. Don't look at them as the immediate out because that's just not what they do. How do you deal with rejection? So this is a really, really good question. So rejection is going to come up all the time as an entrepreneur. It's something that is just natural to the process. As you're building out the company, people are not going to like what you're building. You may be targeting the wrong customer in the beginning, so you're going to be getting rejected from those people. I mean, it's something that you're just going to have to learn. Again, like that first question, uncertainty. You're going to have to learn just deal with people just not getting excited like you about your product. Like, you're probably super passionate about your product. And you're like, oh my God, this is the best thing that ever walked the face of the earth. Most people don't think that. Most people don't believe the same thing that you believe when it comes to your product. And so you're going to have to put it in front of them and see if it's something that they'll bite. And you're going to have to also just deal with the fact that if they don't bite, then they just don't bite. You just move on, right? And so I think something really important to note is you're selling to a market. So you're going to get a certain percentage of those people who are really excited about your product. And then you're going to get a certain percentage of those people who just do not give up about your product, right? And so you just have to delineate like who those people are and make sure that you're putting that product in front of as many people as possible. And then hopefully by when all is said and done, you'll get a certain amount of users who are actually excited about it. So that's one side of it. And then rejection on the investor side, you're going to have more rejection than you've ever seen in your life because there are going to be so many investors, if you're looking for investment, that just do not want to invest in a company that is something like yours. Or if they do, they may have already invested in a company that's like yours. Or I mean, there's just tons and tons of levels in terms of why an investor wouldn't invest. And the likelihood of them saying yes is way, way, way lower than them saying no. So you just have to become acclimated with the feeling of being rejected and okay with that. Like, it's a thing that's not going to be, it's something that's going to happen, right? And it's not something you can navigate around. It's not something you can avoid. It's something that's absolutely going to happen and you just have to deal with it, right? Okay. Next question. Do I pay myself? Okay. So this is a really interesting question because a lot of people, when they're building the business initially, they have a certain amount of budget allocated to building up the business, right? And so traditionally, as you're building the business, all of your resources are going into the business. So it's not necessarily like, okay, I'm going to put a percentage out to the side of profits to pay myself in the beginning. Normally, as the business starts to grow, eventually you will pay yourself because you'll have enough salary to make that happen, but or enough revenue to make that happen, giving yourself a salary. But in the beginning, you're not going to be paying yourself. It's just, you just can't. Like, every cent of revenue should be invested back into the business. It shouldn't be something where you're like, oh, and P.S., I'm going to go ahead and pay myself and then we'll get the business going, right? So just make sure that you have enough for that transitional period in the sense that you're going to have the business up and running and your money is going into the business, and then eventually your money will come out of the business and go back into your pockets, and you're paying the business first. And then if you have enough resources, enough revenue, if you've generated enough cash flow, then you can go ahead and pay yourself. But don't think about that in the beginning. And if you want to create a sustainable, scalable business. Now, if you're just in business and you're like, I just want to make a couple of bucks because I need to pay rent, that is a whole nother conversation for a whole nother day. But if it's something that's sustainable and a scalable business, focus that money back on investing into the business so you can grow the business. Otherwise, you know, then you just have a business where you're, you know, using it to pay rent. All right. So let's see. How do you practice patience when you feel like things aren't working out? Whew, that's a good one. Patience is like the biggest thing for an entrepreneur, because every time you want something to happen, it does not happen on your time. And so for me, I think what's interesting is I'm not pressed for anything. Like, I'm good. Like, I have money coming in. Like, I don't have an issue where I'm like, oh my God, if I don't get this new customer, I'm not going to have, you know, rent next month and like all these things. So I just think when it comes to practicing patience, you can't be desperate. Like, patience does not, it can't foster out of desperation, right? And so when I think about the things and the reasons and the times that I was not patient, it's because I was desperate. It's because I needed things to happen, because if they didn't happen, I couldn't eat, or I didn't know how I was going to pay rent. And like these things that made, that stressed the situation so heavily that I was not patient, which actually I think hurt my first career a lot, because I was always like, okay, I need this next job. Like, I was hitting record labels up like, hey, I need to know when this video is going to book. And like, I'm running around like collecting checks, because like that shouldn't be a thing, but it was. And I'm like, hey, I absolutely need that check because I need to pay my rent. And like, I'm ruining relationships because I'm moving out of a sense of desperation. And so if you have an issue with patience and it's coming from a place of desperation, then you have to figure out why, and you have to figure out how to solve for the other side. So maybe that means getting another part-time job while you're an entrepreneur. Maybe that means keeping your full-time job until you can actually live off of your venture. You know, you have to figure out for yourself what exactly that looks like, but you can't build a company out of desperation, and you have to be patient, because nothing's ever going to happen on your time. It only happens when it's supposed to happen, and it all clicks, and then it just kind of works, right? And you unfortunately cannot predict any of that. So that's how I deal with patience for me, and hopefully that's something that can be helpful to you as well. How do you find work-life balance? Okay, this is an interesting question to me, because I genuinely love what I do. Like, it is so strange to me when I go to somebody and I'm like, you know, talking to some, maybe I'm dating somebody new or whatever, and they're like, well, when do you have time to have fun? And I'm like, dude, my job is fun. Like, what I do for work is fun. So I don't understand like what your question even means. And so for me, work-life balance, like, my job is my life. Like, me doing this radio show is my work, which is my life, which is balance for me. So I just think you absolutely need to be doing something that's fun, that you're excited about, that gets you up in the morning, that makes you get out of bed. And that's how you find work-life balance. Like, I feel really sorry for the people who have to go to a job that they hate and they can't stand being there, because that's when you're looking for a life balance, right? You're looking to figure out, you know, how do I supplement my happiness from this job and do something completely different so that I'm excited? And I don't have that issue. Like, I literally go and do exactly what I want to do every single day. So I just say, find something that you're excited about, do something that you're truly passionate about, even if it's not entrepreneurship, if it's a job that you're going in for a 9-to-5, make sure you're passionate about that job. And then to me, that's when you're going to find your work-life balance. I want to start a company. Where do I get ideas from? Ideas are a dime a dozen, right? So what are some problems that you have, right?
if there's a specific problem that you have, 9 times out of 10, someone else is likely to have that problem. So what you want to do is think about what you're suffering from. My first company, 7 a.m., I had all kind of relationship issues. So I was like, let's build an app that keeps you in relationships, right? Like there's all these apps, these Tinders, these Bumbles, Leagues. I mean, I can name probably 10 other ones, but there's no app actually keeping you in a relationship. So let's build that. So, I mean, for me, that was exciting because other people were like, yeah, you're right. Like, how do we actually stay in the relationship once I get into it? And so that was a problem that I was solving for myself that was relatable to other people. And so I would say if you're looking for an idea, look for a problem that you want to solve in the market that you're super excited about and that you're qualified to solve and work on that. And that could be potentially your $1 million business. Can I have a day job and be an entrepreneur? I kind of touched on that just a second ago. So yes, absolutely. I have a day job and I'm an entrepreneur. I work at Black Enterprise and I am an entrepreneur. So I feel like as long as your day job knows that you're doing that and they're comfortable with that, the worst thing is living two different identities where you have to hide one and then you come out with the other one at night. I mean, if that's what you have to do to make sure that things like work out until you can leave your day job. But I do not advise anybody, like I said on a past episode, struggling on the ramen noodle diet because that's just going to put stress on you. It's going to put you in a desperate spot. Place, which means nothing's going to happen for you the way that you want it to happen for you. And so I say you have to keep that day job until you absolutely don't need it anymore. My day job is congruent with what I do for commas. So it doesn't actually interfere at all. And so I say make sure that if you're going to have a day job, it's not interfering as much as possible. So do that day job. Don't be, you know, doing things that are going to get you fired. But yeah, keep the balance of having the two until you absolutely don't need it. Or make sure that if you have a day job, it's in alignment with what you're doing as an entrepreneur, because that makes things 10 times easier. Is venture capital worth seeking? That's a good question. Okay. My thoughts on venture capital. So a lot of people are not going to build venture backable businesses. That's just it. It's what it is. It's what it's going to be. So at the end of the day, venture capital backed businesses are your businesses that scale really, really large that they either call a unicorn business or a rocket ship business, or like these businesses that like grow to massive size that these investors, these venture capitalists can get a pretty substantial return on their investment. From, right? And so not to get into too many details, but VCs are investing other people's money. Like that's not their money. And so they have to make a profit because they have to pay these people their money back and then they have to pay themselves. So essentially that's how venture capital works. So if you're looking to get into venture capital in terms of seeking investment from a venture capitalist, you have to be building a company that can scale really, really, really large. I mean, and there's nothing wrong at all with building a company that is bite-sized in terms of being just a profitable business and a small to medium-sized business. There is nothing wrong with that. I think it's cool right now. The media portrays, and I am the media, so I can say this. We talk a lot about, you know, your bigger businesses and like those big exits and those big venture-backed deals and like things like that. So I think that's a lot of the conversation of what's out. But I think that there are those small, medium-sized businesses, and I do give light to these too, that actually are generating good revenue. Like example, Slutty Vegan is in Atlanta and they just opened a brick and mortar restaurant and they're doing amazing. Are they going to be a venture-backed business? No, but they're doing amazing. Like customer service or customer-wise, I'm just like blown away. I've never seen so many people so attracted to a brand. And so I just think that you have to be realistic with what your goals are, what your life goals are. If you're not excited about waking up, going into an office, talking to VCs, going out and fundraising, going out and making sure that you have all of these elements that consist of a big tech company attached to you or a big venture-backed company attached to you, then don't do that. If you want a small, medium-sized business, if you're a solo entrepreneur, you want to do something on a smaller scale, it's
totally okay. Be comfortable with that and do that. It's your life at the end of the day. So what do you want to put your time and allocate your resources? That's what it comes down to. Next question. What are some of the mistakes you wish you could have avoided? Y'all ain't got time for all that. There's so many mistakes. Oh my God. Okay. So avoided? No. Okay. Because I learned from a lot of my mistakes. So, I mean, let me think. With 7 a.m., I wish I wouldn't have raised venture first. I wish I would have gone and grown the company. I wish I would have become profitable first. I wish I would have raised it after the fact. I was so caught up in the hoopla of actually raising venture capital that I got sucked into that machine. And I don't think it was the right time. And I don't think it was the right product at that time, right? Eventually, could it have been a great product that lended itself to venture capital? Sure. Like, it was a company that could have scaled and done really, really well. Did it need venture capital? Absolutely not. There was a company very similar who had generated $100 million in revenue and never took an ounce of venture capital. So I would have done that business very differently. And I think that now that I know that, Commas is a supplement of 7 a.m. So 7 a.m. was a company that was based around wellness and making sure that you got your daily affirmations, meditation, wellness, relationship advice, depression. It dealt with a lot of mental health stuff, but coming from like a pop culture twist. So like conversations that were driven by like Kendrick Lamar and like all these like really big pop culture influencers. So Commas is very similar. Like, we deal with a lot of business, but it's all driven by like people who are doing really interesting, cool, and exciting things in business, right? And so I think that now we're profitable, and I wouldn't go and try to raise for this company. It just does not make sense. So I think that was one of the biggest mistakes that I learned in terms of the things that could have been avoided. But just, I mean, I still wouldn't have avoided it, because it's got me to where I am. It's got me the relationships that I have. I have great relationships, phenomenal relationships in Silicon Valley with investors, phenomenal relationships with founders, and it's a part of my journey and my path. So I don't really think, I'm like, mistakes and failure have been given a bad rap. I'm very, very excited about mistakes and failure, because I just like to learn. So I think that if it's coming from a negative perspective, I don't think that, you know, obviously if I could have done 7 a.m. differently, I probably would have made sure that we were generating profit first. But to be quite frank, I'm excited about where it's gotten me. So I don't believe that I don't know that I would have avoided it. How did you know when you had the right solution to a problem? How did you know when you have the right solution to a problem? I think that's what that's supposed to say. Okay, so you know when you find what's called product market fit. So essentially what happens is you're going to all of a sudden see a lot of people very excited about your product, and they're going to pay for it. That's when you know that you have the right solution to the product, because there's going to be a pain point that they're going to say, this is the painkiller, and I'm willing to purchase this painkiller in order to dead this pain, right? And your product is essentially that painkiller. So when people are purchasing and they're excited and they're like, give me more of that, then you know that you found product market fit and you actually have the right solution for the problem. And it takes time. You're going to test, you're going to iterate, you're going to change things. You might even pivot, which means changing the entire thing and doing something completely different. You'll have a whole new solution to that problem, but that's totally okay. Be okay with pivoting, be okay with iterating, be okay with the changes, and embrace those things and know that as you're doing that, you're getting closer to the solution. And fail fast. Like, when you're going through this process, if it's not working, don't spend 6 months on it. Like, get it out there. Let people tinker with it. If they don't like it, put something else out there, right? Just do it quickly and don't spend too much time, because you don't want to be wasting time. So I say maybe 3 months max. If it's like a B2C, like business to consumer business, if it's B2B, they just take longer to adopt. The sales cycle is a lot longer. So B2B, maybe 6 months, maybe. I don't really believe that. I would say, okay, if you have a true interest, if people are interested from the B2B side,
then I would try to lock in sales literally within 5 to 6 months at the longest. Anything beyond that, I'm kind of looking at you a little sideways. Unless it's like some revolutionary innovation that people just don't understand and you need to build out hardware and like all these other things and just to make it work and like all this stuff. So I say customer adoption and interest with an MVP, like a minimum viable product, or at least a prototype, or shoot, in some cases, an idea and a landing page if it's B2C, then you should be able to at least know that you have a solution that people are excited about. How did you handle adversity and doubt? Doubt is a thing. Doubt is a human reaction. You're always going to have doubt. I have doubt every single day. Right? I put something out and I'm like, I don't know if people are going to like this, but at this point, I just got to put it out because if you don't put it out, you will never know. Right? So you're always going to be doubtful. You always are going to have those kind of situations where you're like, is this going to work? Is the market going to receive this? Are people going to be excited? Are people going to be like, you don't know what you're doing. Why are you doing it? Like, there's going to be so much doubt, but that's fine because really the market's going to tell you if it's something that they want or not. So having emotions wrapped around your company is fine, but don't let your own emotions drive you. Don't let that doubt make decisions for you. Let the market make those decisions for you, and you will be able to deal with any adversity or doubt that creeps in. How do you build a team? Okay, so what you do is you find somebody who is in alignment, direct alignment with your business, right? So when I was building 7 a.m., it was all about, like I said, relationship coaching, advising, therapy, those things, right? So I brought on Dr. Wendy Walsh as a co-founder because that's her background. She is known to be the relationship coach, the relationship expert. I'm the tech person, so I was dealing with all the tech stuff. So that's what you do. You look for people that are equally passionate with a different skill set, and you guys team up, make it happen. And that essentially will become your co-founder. And then you guys will build the business together. And as you start to grow and scale, you'll add other team members. But don't focus too much on team if you don't have a co-founder, you know, in place. Make that person the first team member, and then you guys build a bigger team as you start to build the business. And you could have multiple co-founders. Some companies have 3 co-founders. Some companies have 4 co-founders. It just totally depends on how you want to go about the process. But I think that just finding somebody who is really, really excited about what you're doing with, like I said, a different skill set is going to be massively beneficial to you. What's your approach to marketing is the next question. Okay. Ooh, wee. That is a deep, deep question. So I'm going to say, make sure you listen to some past Commas episodes because we've already talked about a lot of these things, but it depends, right? There is social media marketing, and that could be deep. There's a deep dive in that. Influencer marketing, there is an equally deep dive in that. So it literally depends, right? My best advice is to tell you to find exactly where your customers live and engage with them there. So if they live on LinkedIn, you have a lot of entrepreneurship-based content or a business surrounding entrepreneurship or something business-based, then go to LinkedIn. If you have a design business or you have a photography business or you're a model or you have, you know, an agency, a modeling agency or a acting agency, I don't know, anything creative, then be on Instagram. If you have things that are specific to Facebook, be on Facebook. So the best thing for marketing is finding out very specifically where your customer lives and then engaging them on those platforms. Did you experience failures? If so, what did you learn from them? Yeah, I already talked about that. So we're not going to get too much in that. But again, with failure, just make sure you are learning. That's the short of that. And okay, we are coming up on our last question, folks. How did you transition from a full-time job to an entrepreneur? Okay, I still have a full-time job. So I have not transitioned from a full-time job to an entrepreneur, but I say, like I said before, make sure you have a budget. You make sure you have enough money before you make that transition. Do not make that leap without being able to support yourself and the business. That is all I will say about that because I had a lot to say about it earlier. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. And again, if you guys want me to answer your entrepreneurship questions, go ahead and hit our gram, slide into our DMs at Commas The Series, and check us out on commastheseries.com.